Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
Given how crazy the headlines have been, the culture has been, the marketplace has been, I wanted to talk money. Skeptical Money, I think, is the name of a show I recently did with Phil Ferguson, who joins me here on the podcast. Phil, good to have you, my friend.
Oh, thank you very much. How are you doing?
I'm well. You're host of The Phil Ferguson Show. You talk about, well, skeptical money, right? You're a financial guy, but you also sort of branch off and do other things. Set it up for me, if you were to describe what you do.
Yep. The Phil Ferguson Show, I talk about money, politics, and religion, the three things you should not discuss with your family.
And every time we talk about things like Bitcoin, you can always just, every time I see you, I'm like, hey, how's the hate mail on Bitcoin? But anyway, that's not why we're talking today, right?
Yeah, that still stands as the number one most email, and all of it negative. But, I did that when Bitcoin was 20,000 and now it's 5. And funny thing is, on the topic we're going to do today, my little segue, I just did a show, show number 333. It's exactly half of 666. Is the most complimented show I've ever done, because I talked about the coronavirus, the recession, and the stock market, and all the stuff that you talked about maybe we should cover for your listeners today.
Okay. Well, I'm watching the stock market. I mean, I've got a few stocks, right? Just a few. But I'm most interested in the economy as a whole. I'm interested in businesses, right? Especially the mom and pop shops and the smaller corporations who may not be able to weather this particular storm. I want to talk about the panic buying that's going on, and that relates to the stock market. I'm not even sure where to start. So you tell me, what have you been talking about in your circles these days?
Well, one of the things that a lot of my listeners and or clients have done is found a way to scrap up some more money and throw it into the stock market. Now, I'm not saying that's the best thing for everybody to do. I'm not even saying that's necessarily the best thing for the average person to do. But, you know, we follow the old adage to buy low and sell high. It's curious, when the market makes 31% like it did in 2019, no one ever calls me and says, Phil, I just made too much goddamn money. But when the market falls 15 or 20%, still above where it was at the beginning of 19, some people get crazy. I see it potentially as a buying opportunity. And the problem is that you never know how far, how low will it go? You know, if it's down 20, can it be down 50? So probably the single best way to avoid the problems and the drama of market corrections like this, which happen from time to time, is to have a really good portfolio design, not just a couple of stocks or a couple of random mutual funds that someone recommended to you, but actually have a plan and understanding and knowing what you own and why do you own them. And if you're in retirement or near retirement, a generous portion of your portfolio, and that percentage is different for everybody, should be in really boring, lame 1 or 2 or 3% bonds. And making 2% in a bond fund when the market goes up 31% like it did last year looks stupid. But making 2% in a bond fund when the market falls 25% looks genius. So it's about having that broad diversification.
And we threw a little, maybe we've got a little bit of a nest egg. And so we saw everything sort of go down, and we looked and we thought, well, these are specific companies that are, they're going to be around. and they're having a really shitty time right now. But it made sense for us to, and you know, that's probably the conversation we're having. All right, how much lower is this going to go? Like, where's the bottom? And but we jumped in mostly because we're looking at a year, 5 years, even 10 years from now. That's probably the way to go, right? If you're going to jump in now low and it sinks even further, don't flip out because we're looking at a longer game. Would that be a good way to look at it?
Yeah, and I think when you think about the stock market, there is no try. There is do or do not. I think some famous poet said that or something like that once.
Yeah.
It's every once in a while I'll talk to a potential client and they're like, all right, Phil, I like what you're saying. Let's try the stock market for a year. And I'm like, no, you now can't be a client because that's just not how it works. I mean, it's a mental attitude. It's a lifestyle choice that you buy the market. And I don't recommend any individual stocks. I recommend really large pieces of stock markets using index funds so that the turnover is incredibly low, the expenses are incredibly low, the taxes are very efficient. Because one of the problems with buying stocks, it's hard to pick the winners. I can look back at who's done the best over the last 3, 5, or 10 years and tell you who won in the past. But how do I figure that out 3, 5, 10 years ago? So I like to own everything. And I always have an incredibly small investment, mind you, because I own everything, in all the big winners. So when the market goes up, I go up. When the market goes down, I go down. And it's one of those things that every once in a while, I'll probably do this on the next episode of my show, and I did the same thing at the end of 2018, when a few people will call and ask me, Phil, what are you going to do to protect me when the stock market goes down? I'm not going to do a fucking thing. It all goes back to that good portfolio design. You should already be protected. There is nothing to change when the market goes up and when the market goes down. Now, the one thing you might do is a rebalancing. So if for whatever reason, say you had $1 million and you had 300,000 in bonds because that's the right number for you, sidebar, none of this is specific investment advice for anyone actually listening, but if the part that's the stock market goes from 700,000 to 500,000, well, now you have a larger percentage in bonds. Do you want to take some of those bonds and buy stocks and do your rebalancing? Because when the market went up 30% last year, I have a lot of clients close to or in retirement. And we had these conversations saying, hey, you know, that 700,000 part went up 30%. And so you made 200 grand in stocks in 1 year. Let's take some of that 20, 50, 80, 100 grand. Maybe some people say, let's take all of it and put it in bonds, and you do a rebalancing. And so then when the market goes down, it doesn't hurt as much. The rebalancing can add anywhere from 0.5 to 1.5, maybe 2% to your portfolio overall in the long run. And when it's done only once a year, you don't have to do this daily or monthly, but once a year, just check where your plan is, check where your investments are in relationship to the plan that you set up, and rebalance.
All right. I'm not asking you to predict the future, but I'm going to ask you to predict the future at the same time. All right. So that's my caveat. We're watching, you know, essentially travel grinds to a halt. I'm watching the airlines. There have been predictions within the next week. Many will file bankruptcy, et cetera. But the airlines aren't going away, right? They're not going away. There's talks of bailouts and other thing. Do you have any thoughts on whether or not an airline or, you know, the cruise industry or the rental car, anything related to travel would be something worth looking at as everything tanks right now?
You mean as far as investing in them?
Investing in, yes.
Well, I guess the really short answer is no, because I don't do stock picking. I don't do industry picking. I don't say buy computers or buy travel or buy airlines. I don't do any of that. I do it all based on index funds that are based on large cap versus small cap, growth versus value, domestic versus international, stock versus bond. So I don't do any of that stuff.
Well, what good are you? I mean, how am I supposed to take advantage of our friendship And your expertise as a financial advisor, if you can, tell me which stocks to buy, Phil. I mean, this is not working for me. I'm just saying.
Yeah, you take advantage by understanding that you were asking the wrong question.
What's the right question?
Well, the right question is how does one invest? And one invests in index funds. So don't go buy individual stocks. Don't roll the dice. And it can be very tempting because you look at an airline company, and I haven't looked, right? So I don't know. But let's say an airline company, I'm not even going to throw out a name because someone will think that I'm actually quoting something, but airline company ZYX went down 50%. And you think, well, shit, if I buy that stock, if it goes right back, I can double my money. Well, that would be true if it does. And if it does, you'll make money. But if it continues to go down and they do some kind of restructuring and bail out and get money from the government to pay all their debts, but all the shareholders get nothing, you can lose 100%. I don't know how that's going to happen. That's a very risky way to invest. Just like when people were running up the price of Tesla from 300 to 400 to 800 to 900. Now, a few weeks later, it's half that price. So if you bought anywhere on the upside of that rush to go buy a hot thing, and it's the same thing when we talked to 2.25 years ago about Bitcoin, when things just go crazy up or crazy down, it's kind of like rolling the dice at the casino. And that's not something I do. I create a plan on my show, the podcast, The Phil Ferguson Show. I talk about how to create a portfolio. And when the markets change dramatically, like they have in the last few weeks, we don't really make material changes. The biggest change might be to say, let's rebalance now and take some money from bonds and put it in stocks.
All right. So educate me. What's an index fund?
So most people are aware of a stock. And let's say AT&T. You can own stock in AT&T. And for most people, virtually everyone listening to the show, the shares that they own are trivial, incredibly small portion of this giant company that you own. But if the company over time does well, it is presumed and hoped for that your stock goes up and you make money along the way, that the company is becoming worth more money. If that company does poorly or has something terribly tragic happen to it, like Enron, you can get wiped out. Now, the nice thing about stock investing is the most you can lose is 100%. And I say it's a nice thing because if you invest in certain other investments like doing shorts or really tricky leveraged margin calls and stuff like that, you can lose more than you put in. So that's why I stick with just stocks, nothing too fancy. A company can buy a whole bunch of stocks and pick and choose what they think you should invest in, and you just give them the money. And that could be an individual broker making a portfolio for you, which I do not recommend. It can be what's called a managed mutual fund. And, you know, they try to beat the market. That's kind of the goal. But the habit is they don't beat the market. So the next thing is an index fund. And the oldest, most famous one is Vanguard's S&P 500 index fund, which is not the whole market. It's usually the 500 biggest companies, give or take. And you own all those 500 companies and you set it and you forget it. You add money as much as you can, as fast as you can, year after year, month after month. And in the long run, it's very, very likely that not only will you make money, but you're going to make a lot of money. It takes time, and a lot of people have trouble with that. So because the index fund in that case might buy all 500 of the stocks in the S&P 500, there's not a lot of trading costs. They're not doing research trying to figure out which ones to buy and which ones to sell and when to buy more and when to sell more. So a lot of those costs disappear. And so the average managed fund might take 1 to 1.5% of your money per year. Some take 3% or more, and those are usually horrible. But an index fund, instead of being 1%, might be 0.1% or 0.05% expense ratio. So the money that you're out every year shrinks very, very dramatically, and it gives you a better chance not to beat the market, but to beat everybody else.
It's overwhelming. All of these details, for those of us who don't dance in this particular play, you know, we don't play in this sandbox. We're not wired like Phil Ferguson. Sometimes it does seem a little bit like, you know, calculus. But I am, you know, I'm interested in how do we apply reason? How do we apply it for as best we can, an evidence-based approach to what's happening. When you look around from a personal standpoint, do you have an opinion about all this panic that's going on? I mean, we're watching everything disappear from the shelves and people are losing. Some people, a fraction, I think, of the people. I think, honestly, the people I run into every day are like, holy shit, have you seen how crazy things have become? Because they aren't hoarding toilet paper at the grocery store. But there is enough of us doing it and enough of us worried that other people are going to create a shortage that we see it sort of feeding on itself. When you look around, what are your thoughts, Phil Ferguson?
Yeah, it's definitely true. And toilet paper is such a wonderful example because I don't know that I'd want to live without it. I mean, if I had to, I mean, you know, you could get a bidet. There's other things that you could take a shower every time, you know, if you work from home or have the convenience of picking and choosing when you have to go to the bathroom. But yeah, it's a supply and demand thing. And when the demand goes up unexpectedly, the supply runs short and you can get people who do an arbitrage where they're selling these giant bundle packs that cost them $20 in the store for $50 or $80 or $100 online. And, you know, there's price gouging laws, you know, like when gas stations suddenly go to $5 a gallon because they know you'll pay it. That makes that illegal. Normal ripping people off is allowed, but spontaneously doing it when there's an emergency is illegal. So we could have a philosophical debate about the merits of that. But you know, if you normally keep a certain amount of something in your house and then you want to get more of it, if 10 or 20% of the population wants more of it today, it creates a problem. I went and bought a little bottle of hand sanitizer. I think it's, you know, 8 or 10 ounce little pump. And when I went to the store, the entire shelf was wiped out of every brand except for the private label bottle that they had just got a box of 12 in that morning. And just for a brief moment, I thought, well, you know, I could buy all 12 of these and go and deliver them to all my friends and family members.
You
and I
trench coat, you open it up and you're like, all right, yeah. Look, I'll trade you 3 bottles of this for this and yeah. You know, kind of a black market. Yeah.
Would you like to buy a hand sanitizer? Yeah. But no, I got the one that I needed and resisted that urge because especially with something like hand sanitizer, in an era of coronavirus, I want everyone else to be healthy also. Because I don't want them to give it to me. So, you know, there's that thought process that, you know, get what you need and then come back if you can. Now, there are going to be people who get quarantined or self-quarantine or who can't go out. And maybe we can work with each other. Maybe if your neighbors aren't all assholes, you could go make a run so that you get everything for 2 or 3 families with just one person going. So there's less people interacting that slows down the spread of the disease. It's interesting times. And it's funny because one of the things, a little bit different thing that I hate the most that I've seen is Louisiana and Ohio have postponed their primary elections. I do not like that. I do not like that a lot. I do not like the precedent that it sets because I do not trust the orange one to look at that and say, hey, Democrats did this a few months ago. I'm just going to postpone the national election till next year until we're past all this.
Oh, it's going to
be
great.
I don't want that to be an option.
Somebody asked me how I felt about all these press conferences. And I'm like, oh, don't worry, folks. The guy who once asked if we could drop nuclear weapons into hurricanes and said we could stop the California wildfires by raking the forests and called climate change a hoax by the Chinese government, that person's handling corona. So there's no reason to panic, folks. It's going to be okay. So.
I'm very conflicted about this. And I had this on my show and talk a little bit about it here as you allow. I want to make it perfectly clear. I loathe Donald Trump more than almost any human being I've ever met in my life. And I like most people. There's a couple. There's a couple I've met over the years that are just slime balls that will steal your grandmother's necklace and sell it for $10 just because they can. Not that Donald Trump has ever stolen anything. I don't even want to plant that idea in your head. It's not like I said that. But I loathe him with a deep, profound passion. And right behind him is Pence, the guy who helped promulgate, I guess, create a scenario for AIDS spreading in his own state. These are people who have made a long history of choosing the wrong thing for others. However, if my choice is for Trump to look good and the coronavirus to be nipped in the bud, I'm compelled, for the benefit of my fellow man and fellow woman, that the coronavirus gets nipped in the bud. And some of these conferences that they're having, and I know the bar is so incredibly low, but Trump coming out with doctors and scientists, even though some of them have a checkered past or problematic history with AIDS, they look rather competent. And I'm very disturbed by that, because I don't even want to think that Trump can be competent looking. But they're telling people of 10 or more, don't hang out together, because that's how this virus spreads, from person to person, mostly through particles in the air, the actual virus in the air. They already put in $1.5 trillion of stimulus into what's called the repo market, which it's an unfortunate name, because it's not like, you know, they're going to repo your car. It's the repurchase market of U.S. government bonds. And the reason they did that is not to prop up the stock market per se, but to provide liquidity between all the banks, because every bank has a minimum amount of cash they have to have on hand overnight. And if they're short money, if they've lent out too much money, then they go to the Fed, the Federal Reserve, and they borrow money, sometimes tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, and they borrow that overnight at an incredibly low rate, which just went down from 1 to 1.25 to 0 to 0.25%, and they borrow that money. If times are tight, or if anyone has trouble paying their loans back, banks could be put under harder and harder pressure to cover the overnight requirements. And those are in place to make sure banks are relatively safe and stable. But if the banks can't make their numbers, they might start calling loans in, which is part of what happened in 08. There was a liquidity crisis. And I don't want banks to get zero interest loans, even if they're overnight. I want them to suffer if they're screwing people and doing the bad thing. But if banks were to get to the point that they failed, it does affect a lot of low income and people that have needs if the economy goes south. So we don't want a recession, but I also don't want this money going to banks through this repo market. But in the short term, it's a nice thing to do, because we don't want a recession. We don't want a crashing economy. Talking about bailing out airlines and banks and cruise ship companies, I think that's pretty sound. But I also thought it was pretty sound when we bailed out GM, because we want really big manufacturing companies to exist in the United States. We want people to be able to make airplanes, Boeing and McDonnell Douglas and all those companies. We don't want all of that work to be done somewhere else in the world, because if they decide they don't like us, we suddenly can't get planes or cars. So, you know, this is what I consider a black swan event. It's not something that could be specifically predicted. Now, if you want to go to level of Nostradamus and say someday in the future there'll be a virus that spreads around the planet, yay, you know, eventually you'll be right. But it's now. It's happening now. And what's the right step? I'm also amazed that Republicans are talking about the idea of sending every citizen under a certain income limit a $1,000 check. And that would help people that work the gig economy. That might help the people that work at McDonald's or Burger King that now aren't working because no one's going out to eat, because maybe they shouldn't. A matter of fact, in Illinois right now, you can get food from any restaurant as long as it's takeaway. It is technically illegal, or I guess not recommended. I don't know if they're going to put anybody in jail yet. But you can't go into a McDonald's or a Burger King or a Dairy Queen and sit down and have a meal. You can walk in and get it, get out, or you can drive through. And it even the inside parts will probably be closed and only do drive through at some point. So the demand goes down. Why do I need to pay someone to flip the burgers if their sales are down? So those people who aren't making much suddenly get nothing. So sending $1,000 to everybody is a great idea, and I'm all for it. But this is from the administration that literally 2 weeks ago was calling this a hoax. The spin on a dime is absolutely staggering. And the people that follow Fox News, the people that love Donald Trump, thought he was right when he called it a hoax. And now they think that he's been on this for 2 months, 3 months, and he's been doing the right step every single time. And it's the liberals who are getting together, having parties, spreading the disease and infecting true Americans.
Oh, that's the conspiracy, right? It's not actually.
Yeah. Yesterday, maybe it was 2 days ago now, I had in the same day, I had a Republican tell me that it was that coronavirus is a hoax. And a couple hours later, I had a different Republican friend tell me that Trump has been working on this since the beginning and it's the liberals holding him back. And I was like, well, which is it?
Yeah.
But neither one of them is technically right. But they both think they are. And it's just like arguing with religion. Apologetics arguments don't have to be good. They only have to be good enough.
Oh, I'm interested in the dissolution of the U.S. pandemic response team a couple of years ago. And the Independent just came out and has a video of Trump's press conference where he said, they weren't being used. So we disbanded it. We just cut the cord. Which is in contrast to what he'd said just a few days ago when he said, well, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like he just completely sloughed that one off as if he had no knowledge. And the fact that the evidence has now been unearthed that he was at the front of the decision and knew all about it makes no difference to those who were going to support him anyway. It's kind of a terrifying truth of the moment rather in world history. It's bizarre. So.
It is the line I've said a couple times on Facebook, and I'll explain it in a minute, but some listeners will understand the very moment they hear it. We have always been at peace with Oceania. And what I'm talking about is from 1984, where they would rewrite history the moment that present changes. Because who controls the present can control the past, will then control the future. And so Trump says it's a hoax, it's a hoax, it's a hoax, it's a hoax. And all of a sudden he goes, oh, crap. If people start dying, particularly elderly people who vote more regularly Republican, I'm going to be out of office and I'm going to be up on charges and criminal activity. And I'm going to go to jail. What do I have to do to keep this freaking office? I got to look like I'm doing everything I can. And they are doing amazing things. They finally got tests going out maybe 2 months late, but his followers won't care because they'll say he sent out 1 million tests. The service that he disbanded, he says that wasn't doing any good. It wasn't even designed for this. We've created a whole new thing that's never been done before. That's great for his fans. We're going to test more and bigger and better, and it's going to be stronger than any tests ever. It's going to be like nothing you've ever seen before. The same language he uses for everything. It's just a con show, but it's good enough. It's just good enough. And if it's good enough for enough people, he gets reelected, and this thing turns from the world's biggest turd where Trump screwed everybody into he spent endless amounts of money. He sent me a check for $1,000. How great is Trump? People are going to get these checks and they're going to need these checks. So I don't think it's a bad idea, but these are the same people are going to get this check and go cash it and go spend it at Walmart, who just a few days ago said Obama was evil for sending out checks 10 years ago to people the same way that Trump's doing it now. And they're
socialist.
Not even going to make,
sounds a little
they're not going to make the connection. Yeah. Oh, it totally is. Yeah. And funding for setting up drive-through testing sites, helping get ventilators and breathing machines and stuff to hospitals. That's all socialism. And of course, you know, we're getting to the territory here where the government is telling what businesses can stay open and which ones can't, and what their hours can be, what kind of business they can do. And I used to think just a few days ago, try telling someone in Texas that they can't drive their truck with a gun rack in the back to Oklahoma. They'll never accept that, but now they might. Wow.
Yeah.
I just can't wrap my head around it. And the funny thing is, I do want him to succeed.
Yeah, it's still a weird place to be. You know, like, we don't want to see a con artist succeed in the overall con, but we do want to root for the success of people. We don't root for the failure of our own country. We don't, or humankind in general, whether it's within these subjectively drawn borders or all around the world. But at the same time, when you see somebody who has a long history of deception and conish behavior, bullying and predatory behavior, all these other things, that you don't want to see that person succeed on a matter of principle. So it puts us in this weird, sticky situation where, you know, if he comes off looking great, does it facilitate a longer con and a longer period of, you know, does the circus go on for another 4 years? Short break. When I come back, more with Phil Ferguson of The Phil Ferguson Show about what in the world's going on and what do we do next. We'll continue after this. My patrons get this show totally commercial free. They get the show early, and you can become a patron at patreon.com/Seth Andrews. I'm talking with friend and financial guy Phil Ferguson of The Phil Ferguson Show about the wild swings going on in the market, this crash, and will it recover, and can we make money, and what happens to the rest of industry and business and everyday people at all levels, and holy shit, what's happening? And I wanted to get Phil's perspective on all of this. We saw a big, you call it a correction, I'll call it a crash. Right after 9/11, the stock goes to shit. We saw the big housing crash of 2008, which was just mind-blowing. And here we are in 2020, and we're seeing this historic drop. This stuff then, do we call it cyclical? Like, is it just a natural part of any economy that's shaped like ours? You know, you're going to have these moments every decade and a half, every decade, well, every few years. How do we approach that?
The more free-flowing and open the market is to do whatever it wants, the more dramatic and the more frequent those cycles are going to be. So over the last 100-plus years, we as a society, governments, have put in a lot of guardrails, you know, like the things that pop up in the gutters for a bowling alley that stop you from going off one side or the other. And they work pretty well. A lot of them have been slowly dismantled. And it's not just Republicans. It's been Republicans and Democrats that dismantle this. Maybe because they're getting funded by companies that think they're going to profit from these rules being dismantled. And I think we should have a lot of those back. As an example, a bank, your bank in your town, should not be issuing stock for a new stock offering. That should be a different kind of company. And if the stock offering goes bad and they lose their ass, they all go out of business, then get wiped out, tough for them. You know, they rolled the dice. They could have made a ton of money. They could have lost a ton of money, and they did. But it doesn't have anything to do with your local bank. I want your local bank to be really boring and really safe. And you put your money in there and you get your money out. You want a loan for your car? You can do that. So those things shouldn't be allowed to cross-pollinate like they do now, which is how we ended up with some of the bank failures in 08. And after that, you would think we would have learned, but we didn't. Banks are more consolidated. Banks are bigger. Fewer bigger banks control more of the market than they did in 2008. And that's a problem. I think we should break them apart, just like AT&T got broken apart, just like Standard Oil before that got broken apart, because one of the eventual outcomes from unregulated competition is monopoly. That's the point of the game. Your goal is to win. And if you do well year after year after year, you eventually win. Standard Oil own the oil fields, own the refineries, own the distributors, own the gas stations, own the gas pumps, and you open your own gas station in a little town in America, and they drop the prices, you go out of business because you're just a little guy. And then once you're out of business, the price goes up and they make more than they ever did. That's the power of a monopoly. And the company that I'm most worried about now, quite frankly, and I love them. I love them because they bring stuff to my door every day. Amazon. It's too big. You shouldn't have a company making the products, running the factories, doing the distribution, doing the sales, doing the delivery. They control everything up and down the stream. And if you want to sell your product outside of a store, I mean, if you can't get into a store, you've got to go through Amazon. And with a whim, someone can decide, we're not going to have your product anymore, or we're not going to allow you to sell because you violated one of our rules. And who do you go talk to? It's just like years ago, I had Google Ads on my blog. And one day they just said, you aren't in compliance with the rules. I never did find out why. I couldn't ever get a hold of a human being to find out why. We don't want that kind of stuff. But as it is, Amazon is magical. And I'm getting off the subject, of course.
It's all right. Yeah. If you've seen that, it's a meme going around in the internet. It shows a porch and there are stacks and stacks and stacks of boxes. And it says, don't drink and prime. And yeah, I'm guilty of that. Yeah. I don't drink, but I do prime. And I prime.
Yeah. I do billing for my business once a quarter, and I just, it's 2 weeks away. And I looked and I said, oh, I'm not sure I have enough paper. So I ordered paper. I ordered envelopes. I ordered ink cartridges of all the colors for my printer. And I order all this stuff. And tomorrow it's going to show up at my door. And I don't have to go out and interact with other yicky humans. So that's kind of nice that we can do a lot of that. But, it's not always the right thing. If you had asked me probably just 2 days ago, I would have said that we're very likely to have a recession. And I want to make a point about this because this causes conspiracy theories. And I've heard it for decades now because of what I've been doing. A recession, as defined, is two consecutive calendar quarters with a negative GDP or gross domestic product. So even if things go to shit in the middle of March, as long as January, February, March shows a non-negative number, zero or above, then the recession can't have started in the first quarter. If the second quarter and third quarter are negative, and you have two negative GDP consecutive calendar quarters, you then can, in October, say, we are in recession. If that happens, there will be people, because there always are, who go, I knew that in 6 months ago we had a recession. Well, no, you didn't fucking know it because you didn't have the GDP numbers for two consecutive quarters. Now, it's just the way the system works. That's just the way that is defined. Now, a recession in and of itself is not necessarily bad. And I was very, very high in my expectations that we will have a recession this calendar year. However, that has now changed. And why has that changed? Because $1.5 trillion was put into the bond market to buy bonds back. The Fed is buying bonds from the Treasury and from the public at large and from banks to create more cash flow. Some people would go crazy because that's fiat currency and we're just printing more. That's exactly what they did. I'm not saying it's bad. I actually think that's one of the biggest strengths of a currency is that you can create more when things get tight. So that helps ward off a recession. Sending $1,000 or $3,000 or $5,000 to people via check, or maybe it's $1,000 a month until it's determined that we're really past the coronavirus. It allows people to eat and buy shoes and jeans and pay their rent. That helps ward off a recession. Of course, the other question is, at some point, when does this shit get paid back? And who pays it back? Quite honestly, I thought it was a horrifically bad mistake to give tax cuts to the very, very wealthy people when things are going well. That's when you tax them a little bit more because they're making a ton of money. Everybody's drinking champagne and passing around a plate of caviar. Jack up the taxes by 5% and pay off some of the freaking debts, because when everything goes into shitter, the government is the last backstop of financial solidness. I don't know.
Stability. I'll say stability.
Stability. I like that. I'm going to steal it. And they're the one that has to spend money to make sure, because you can get caught in this spiral where if everyone loses their job, any money they have, they don't spend because they might not get another job. And then stores don't sell as much stuff. They lay off some more people. Then the gas stations don't sell as much gas, so they lay off some people. And it just creates this cascade where how in the hell does that ever stop? Well, one of the best ways is to lower interest rates, which I dropped earlier. They did to create cash supply so that banks can do more loans at these low interest rates because they have the ability to. That's a nice thing. But on the other hand, who is going to build a new factory to make little toy cars to sell to people if no one wants to buy a little toy car? So people have to have some money for companies to ever want to open up new factories. It's just like when I would argue with people about the tariffs. You know, we're going to create these steel tariffs on steel from China. That's great, but if you're a company and you're going to have to invest $500 million or $1 billion to open a factory that takes 3 years, you need some kind of freaking assurance that the tariff is going to be there in 3 years, and there never was that assurance. So our steel industry didn't go up at all. Matter of fact, it suffered because the vast majority of steel that's produced in the United States is specialty steel, and they would buy the bulk general framing steel from China, and the specialty steel for, you know, doors or a certain type of wall or in unique places where they need something different, because there's all different kinds of steel. But they don't buy any of that when they're not building anything because the regular steel went up so much. And so there's all these consequences. Everything has consequences. But if we start handing out $1,000 per person for people that don't make a lot of money, that prevents them from getting kicked out of their apartment. That prevents them from getting broke. And maybe $1,000 isn't even enough. Maybe it goes more. And the Republicans are promoting this as a great idea. And I think it is a great idea. But just a couple of weeks ago, they would have called you a commie bastard for suggesting something like that. It's a bizarre world. I don't even know what to think anymore, other than Trump's an asshole and he's got to go.
Let's talk about, I'm talking here with Phil Ferguson. He's host of the Phil Ferguson Show. He's a financial, I call you a financial advisor. I mean, is that right? Does that feel right? What do I call you?
Yeah. The funny thing is that for financial advisors, for wealth managers, financial planner, none of those words have any legal status. So literally anyone can use them. Now, it gets a little dicey if you give specific investment advice to a person and collect money for that advice. Now, that's a legal definition of somebody that has to be registered with the government. My company, Polaris Financial Planning, is an RIA, Registered Investment Advisor. And I am a IAR. It's weird, almost the same letters, but in a different order. Individual advisor representative. Those are the legal definitions. Those are the ones that have meaning and provide rules that one must follow. But your attorney or your accountant or your insurance agent can give you, Seth, you can give anybody any financial advice you want. You could tell people when to buy the stock and when to sell the stock and call yourself a financial planner. There's absolutely nothing preventing you from doing that in any way until you also do that and charge money.
Don't take any financial advice from me, dude.
Well, and I tell people don't take financial advice from a freaking podcast. Who the fuck am I? I'm just a guy with his own little,
you know, you play in this sandbox though. And I mean, you speak the language. So I'm saying you're not Jesus, but you certainly have more credibility at the table than I have, and that's why we're talking today. How much, in your opinion, the market's all about perception, right? People panic, people lose their minds, people start to wig out, and perceptions often drive investments. Do you have any thoughts on that? And I'll tack this on, the role of the media. Has the media been responsible? Has the media overreacted? Has it fueled this panic? Big question. What do you think?
Let me start with the media first. The conservative media has had their head in the sand and talked about the coronavirus as a joke for months. If anyone's to blame for anything happening or not happening, that's where the blame needs to go.
Sean Hannity now, and all those cats, right?
Now, everyone else in the world, all the other media in the United States, quite honestly, I think they underplayed this. And that's That's some doing, because the real problem with this is the geometric nature of the virus. And I did send you a note. I think maybe you had an error in one of your earlier posts. Coronavirus spreads much more quickly than the flu. It's easier to catch. It's easier to give it to a dozen people versus one person like the flu. The believed and so far seen death rate is wildly higher. In the United States, death from flu on average is 0.1%, 0.1 or lower, even 0.05 or 0.04. And it varies from year to year, from maybe a quarter of a percent to, well, from 0.1% to a fraction of that. The coronavirus may, and depends on where you are, have a death rate of 3.4. That's what the prediction is from the World Health Organization. Maybe a little higher, maybe a little lower. I mean, we don't really know until it's all done. Because of the speed of the spread, and because you can actually have the coronavirus for days or even weeks and bumble around in your life and spread it to a dozen people before you show the first freaking symptom. That's absolutely amazing, the ability of how that can spread. There have been predictions anywhere from 30% to 80% of the U.S. population can get this within the next 12 months. It doesn't look like it's going to go away over the summer. If it's 30% of the people, 330 million, 30%, give or take is 90 million people. If only 1% of those people die, that's 900,000 people. Well, that's a lot of people. And what offends me, and I still see these memes where people say, oh, the German flu in this year and this flu in this year killed a million people. This one killed 1.2 million people. And my response to them is, maybe we don't want to kill a million people anymore. You know, that's why we react. They'll send me these things, like someone sent me a thing. I had to look because I thought it was so ridiculous. They said, more people die from a snake bite every day than have died from coronavirus. And I was like, what? And when I looked it up a week or so ago, that was true. It's no longer true. And the coronavirus, it's not about how many people have died. It's how many people can die, how many people might die. And what are we willing to do as a society to present or prevent 1 to 3 to 5 to 10 million people dying in the United States alone? Those are the things that are possible. And that shouldn't create a panic. I want that to create an awareness that this is fucking serious. Your chance of dying as a 30-year-old from the coronavirus is ridiculously small compared to an 80-year-old. But it's way higher than you as a 30-year-old dying from the flu. It still happens. It's still going to happen. And the United States is 11 days behind Italy, based on the current number of people that have tested positive, which could imply that 11 to 10 days from now, we're going to have 25 to 30,000 people infected. And maybe our medical system is as good as Italy's. Maybe it's better. I don't know how one compares that and knows, but I'm not the person to know that. And the hospitals can handle a lot, but can they handle 10,000 people? Can a local hospital take in an extra 500 people? I mean, sometimes we have a multi-car accidents, you know, where 10 or 15 or 20 people suddenly need to go to a hospital and they go to two or three different hospitals. That's a handful of people. What happens when 1,000 need to go to your hospital? In Italy, they now have beds in hallways and in tents outside, like a MASH unit, triage tents. And there are doctors who are deciding, this person has a low probability of survival and needs a ventilator for 2 weeks. And these two people over here would need 1 week each. Let's save the two younger people and the older person doesn't get any treatment and they're going to die. That fucking sucks. I don't want to make that decision, but somebody's got to do it. And I don't think we're at that point in Seattle, maybe in New York or Boston. But what happens when it spreads across the entire country? And so now the death rate goes up, not because the disease is any more deadly. It's just that we've blown out the capacity. I've seen pictures of doctors and nurses who are sleeping with their heads on a desk, or they have a room set aside where they just assume they're all going to get freaking coronavirus. And so the doctors and the nurses that are infected with the coronavirus but don't have symptoms or don't have bad symptoms still keep working 16-hour days, 20-hour days. And you have an illness like this and you work like that, then some of those people are going to die. And they know that going in. I mean, that's a hero. Man, I don't even want to work 16 hours period on any day.
But back to the idea of perception driving the markets.
I wander. You got to keep me focused.
That's all right. I want to talk a little bit about that, and I will get to you on the switchboard in just a second. Are there people who manipulate the fears of the population in order to move money? Well, I don't know. That sounds rather Illuminati-esque, but what do you think?
Yeah. There always can be. That. I mean, there's a big story about a guy that drove all over backwoods Kentucky and Tennessee buying up every little bottle of hand sanitizer they could get so they could sell them for $5 or $10 or $15 or $40 on Amazon. So that person's, they're doing an arbitrage. They're finding something that's worth $3 and they find someone who's willing to pay $20 for it. Is that good business? Or is that evil? And where's that fine line? The perception, if the perception is that the market's going to go down and our economy is going to crash, and if everyone thinks that, it probably will be true. Now, the question that I give to my listeners is, what do you do with that information in regards to your portfolio? My suggestion for the vast majority of people is ignore it, because the housing crisis of 08, the dot-com bubble of 99-2000, and the previous thing, and the previous thing, and the previous thing, every time the market has collapsed so far, because I can only go with what I have, every time the market has collapsed, it comes back. And now, if you're 25 years old from a financial perspective, the best thing that could ever happen to you is for the market to fall by half and stay down there for a decade while you keep piling in money and buying more and more shares that nobody wants, and then it goes up. If you're near retirement, you want to have a balanced portfolio. So that mood can definitely swing the markets. And we've seen the markets swing sometimes dramatically when Trump does a press call. I mean, he did that presentation on Friday, which was the first thing that he did that looked serious and it looked organized and it looked professional. And I know that hard for me to say, but the market jumped 5%. In the last 20 minutes that it was open on Friday, because people suddenly the fears were put aside and go, okay, wow, they're on this. And then shitty stuff happens over the weekend and Monday the market goes in the toilet. And then people go, oh, well, maybe they are working on it. And then it goes back up. So what is the right number for the market? It's whatever people are willing to pay. I don't know what it's going to do tomorrow, but I'm pretty sure I know what it's going to be like in 10 years. It's going to be higher than it is now, because that's what has always happened. Even if you look at the Great Depression, 7 years later, you had your money back. Now, if you play with the numbers, you can make it look like 24, and I've done a segment on that. But if you look at the same 30 stocks, if you include their dividends, and if you incorporate the deflation of the U.S. dollar during that time frame, it only took 7 years for the Dow to come back even then. So, if you're investing in the long term, the stock market is the only game to play, and you just have to keep doing it year after year. You don't try it. You just do it.
Sorry about my dog. He heard you talk about the guy who was trying to scalp hand sanitizer, and Linus got very upset. He was very mad.
Don't blame him.
Barking. I love the way you talk about Donald Trump, where, you know, when he actually looks coherent and measured, it's such an anomaly that we have to stop and talk about it. He actually looked calm, and you know, he wasn't tweet storming and flying off the cuff and saying bizarre shit, and it was really refreshing. I love the fact that we live in a culture where we have to actually stop and do that. Let me take a phone call. 703, you're on the Thinking Atheist podcast. You're talking to Phil Ferguson. Who's this?
Yes, I'm Karen. Hello.
Karen, thanks for waiting on me. What do you think about all this mess?
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, it really is. I don't know what to think about a lot of it. I'm working from home. My daughter is not in school. It's just weird.
Do you have a comment or question for Phil?
I basically called.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes,
go ahead.
Yes, I did. Well, first I want to thank you for having this. Thank you for having this podcast, because it's very timely. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
And I think Phil may have answered my question on the time I was on hold, but I'll go ahead and ask it anyway. I'm asking for someone who is an investor like me. I just have money in a 401k and an IRA. And I do index funding with my IRA. It sounds like I follow a lot of Phil's advice already. And I have a certain asset allocation that I follow, 80% equities, 20% bonds. I'm not looking at anything. I'm just going forward. I keep investing. I'm not even looking at see where all my money is right now. And I start to wonder sometimes, because I hear people talking about it, do I just have my head in the sand? I mean, should I be looking at this? I mean, I don't usually rebalance until July. So should I just wait until July like I always do?
I would wait until July.
This is not specific market advice. Don't we have to do a disclaimer again?
No.
There's something, Phil.
Yeah.
Okay, all right,
no,
go ahead.
I'm basically asking whether people should... Okay.
No, go ahead.
Okay, I was just basically asking in general, for people like me, should we just not look at the stuff and keep just going forward with what we're doing? And I think that was answered earlier when I was on hold, but
yeah, and
I just wanted to verify that.
I think Warren Buffett said that the best strategy for a portfolio is benign neglect. So you set it and you forget it. If your thing is 80% stock and 20% bonds, that's golden. Now, you and I might have a disagreement. Maybe you should be 30% bonds, or maybe I think you should be 10% bonds or whatever. And that's a discussion you can have at any time. But if you've decided that 80-20 is your rule, cool. Now, one thing you could do, since there's been such a big change, is to go into your 401k program and say, rebalance now. That wouldn't bother me. Waiting till July, if you do it once a year in July, that also won't bother me. But the thing that you cannot do is panic. And the thing that you cannot do is look at it, because when the market went up 31% last year, did you think about selling some of your stocks because you made too much money? You probably didn't, because we ignore that. As a matter of fact, with the market up 31%, and even as of today, the year to date on the stock market, if you go all the way back to January 1st, 2019, most people are still up money. We have a very bad habit of, when we get our quarterly statements, if the statement is higher than the last quarter, that's the new amount we expect we should have, and it should always go up. So even when it goes down a small amount, it can be very misleading. What else did you have, Karen?
Well, that was basically it. I mean, people like me that, you know, we put money in every month, put it in with our 401k or with our IRA. I mean, it seems like so many people are looking and rebalancing and doing things now. My thought was, well, maybe you just keep doing what you're always doing and just... to use the phrase that I've heard before, stay the course. So
yeah. Either one of those strategies is perfectly fine with me. I've told people, because I'll have clients call me, or someone calls me and has questions maybe, and they say, I'm sure you're really busy right now because a lot of your clients are probably calling you in panic. No, I've had two that were a little concerned and wanted to talk. But out of 250 clients, nobody is panicking. Matter of fact, the most frequent activity that my clients are doing is sending money in and saying, Phil, invest this today. And that's cool, and I'll do what I can. That's not normally how I do things. It's not, you know, I don't do trading activity, but I'm delighted that most people are taking this as an opportunity to buy. And the example I give to people is, You know, if you go to a department store, if they still exist, because I don't go shopping like that, but you see a sweater that you want and it's $200. And you think, wow, that's a pretty nice sweater, but it's $200. I don't know if I want to spend $200 on a sweater. I'll think about it. And you forget about it. Right? You go home, whatever. A year later, you go in that same store and that sweater, guess what? It's $300. So now you buy it. We don't think about groceries or clothes that way. But when you see a stock that went from $200 to $300, people get excited. Is the company worth 50% more than it was a year ago? And how the fuck do you know? I mean, do you have the skills to evaluate a company? And if it's worth 50% more than it was a year ago, but the stock is 50% higher, it's no better of a deal for you to buy it than it was a year ago. But people get so excited. It went up. If I had owned that a year ago, I could have made a ton of money. Yeah, if you did, but you didn't.
Now, we need a time machine. Like, somebody develop a time machine. I mean, I know it would be unethical, but, you know, if we could just go back in time and buy, you know, Google and Apple and a few of these things back in the early days. I'm just saying. I appreciate your call so much. Thanks for being a part of the conversation. Karen, I hope things go well for you, okay?
Hey, thank you.
All right. Appreciate you. Phil, we've been talking for an hour. Any final thoughts before we call it a day? I mean, as you sort of look ahead to the rest of 2020, you got any advice that isn't binding advice, just, you know, something that we can actually toss out to everybody?
If they want a slightly, maybe even less coherent rambling on these topics, my show number 333, The Phil Ferguson Show, episode 333, goes over coronavirus, recession, stock markets, a lot of the stuff we've been talking about today. It might be redundant, but, you know, maybe hearing it a second time helps some people. I do have a list of books that I recommend people buy and read. Would that be okay?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I'll link your show in the description box here.
The four books, and I do recommend that they are read in order. The first one is The Richest Man in Babylon. Be aware, the book is like 100 years old, so it's not particularly woke. So it might have some things that might bother some readers, but it does convey the message of why you should invest and maybe some general guidelines about how one does such a thing. So it's a really nice beginner. You can find it being read out loud on YouTube because it's out of copyright. So it's a really cheap and easy way. You can get it in print by several different publishers or on Kindle, audiobook, whatever format you want. The second book is A Random Walk Down Wall Street. And all the books I recommend are old. I don't like hot, new, trendy things. I like to know about shit that works. But this book, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, every 5 or 6 years gets updated. And you read that book to get a foundational understanding of the industry. What are stocks? What are bonds? What are mutual funds? What's an opened end versus a closed end? How do dividends work? All that stuff. Because the next two books, if you don't understand the basics of how things work, it's really hard to put them in a framework. The third book is called Winning the Loser's Game. And it talks about why index funds beat everything else. And then after you finish that, the fourth book is Common Sense on Mutual Funds. And this is the one book where I will insist that you must get the hardback version. It has tables, graphs, charts, diagrams. You are going to need to see them on the page that they're related to. Do not look at it in Kindle. The audiobook, I actually own the audiobook version too, just to get ideas and inspiration sometimes for podcast segments. But it's completely meaningless when someone says, look at Fig 1 and talks about it, and you don't look at Fig 1 because you're driving your car and you're listening to an audiobook. It just, you got to buy the paper version. If you read these four books and understand half of what's in them, I think you will beat 90% of all investors. You're not going to be the best, but who gives a shit? If you save 20% and you do well enough and you give it some time, you're going to be okay. Right. And that's the way to do it.
Phil Ferguson of The Phil Ferguson Show, thanks for spending an hour with us. I'll put a link to your show in the description box, and we'll ride out the roller coaster and see where it takes us, and hopefully talk again soon, okay?
Grazie, signore.
Thank you.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.